Good morning and welcome to Backstage Pass, your VIP all access to the 1-2 family. I am Raven McMinn and I am joined by my wonderful co-host, the resident wizard of all things 1-2, Mr. Jay Varvel. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Raven. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, doing good. The intention of the show is to provide all of you with the opportunity to get to know the host of 1-2 Radio and the advisors at 1-2 Listen on a more personal and intimate level. We have a private Facebook chat room where you'll be able to ask them questions during the show or post comments for them. And I'm going to let Jay take it away and explain to you how to get to the chat room.
Head on over to, if I can get my voice, head on over to 12radio.com. Click on the chat button, and that's there on the left-hand side of the screen. It does open up a brand new window. It is a private Facebook chat group with the same name, 12radio. Go ahead and send over an invitation. If this is your first time, we'll get you accepted while we're live on the air. Once you're in, you'll be able to see our banner at the top of the page. You'll see the Backstage Pass banner. And today, you will see another banner there that we'll introduce in just a second. But in the comments section is where the conversation's happening, and we would love for you to join us there. Are there any announcements before we head into our guest and who we're interviewing
today? I am not aware of any. Do you?
The only one I remind everybody of is keep an eye out because there are some moon projects that are coming up. The next one is next week.
Oh, yeah.
And you can get all that information over on 12academy.com. And then, as always, we're having sales at 12listen. So come check all of us out over at 12listen.com for one-on-one support. And so now I'm going to take it over, or I'm going to hand it over to Raven, not take it from Raven. I need more coffee, apparently.
I do, too.
I'm going to hand it over to Raven and so she can introduce our wonderful guest.
Oh, we have the very lovely and talented Ms. Erin Carrera with us today. And Erin has been with 1-2 for a very long time. She's super talented. I don't think there's anything this lady can't do. And she's got a new adventure here, and a new thing to add to her list of accomplishments. And I'm going to bring her right in so we can get down and talk about this. Good morning, Erin. Welcome to Backstage Pass.
Yay! Thank you for having me, you all. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you know what? The truth is I cannot whistle and I can't dive. I know that's how.
Well, there's two small, very small things. My gosh, you do producing, you do acting, you do singing, you do dancing, you do it all. You're just one of the most well-rounded entertainers. Plus, you're a psychic medium and medical intuitive. You do all kinds of wonderful work here at 1-2 Listen. And so, I mean, you're just so multi-talented.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things I love about 1-2 Listen and 1-2 Radio is that it keeps me in service, of being of service to other people. And therefore, I think that keeps me very grounded as an artist. It's all channeling. You know, it's all channeling one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My question,
right.
Sorry, guys. I'm.
Go ahead.
I still need more coffee, apparently. But my question that came when you were mentioning all the different talents that you have, is it seemingly different for you, like individualized in your mind, or is it, like you just said, where it's channeled and you don't like separate it, where it's not so individualized as it might appear to us looking at it from the outside?
Yeah, to me, I'm always Erin. I'm always just myself. So it's more that the genre and the intention changes. So if I'm doing a channel, if I'm on 1-2 Listen and someone calls and they want to speak about a relationship, we are channeling information from spirit about that relationship. And then there might be, depending on what they want, there might be some of the many years of life and love coaching training that I've received and done. We might have some coaching in there too, unless they don't want that. So, but that's specifically, that is a channel connecting up to spirit that is with an intention of helping somebody with a particular question about relationship. Well, if I'm writing a screenplay, because my husband and I write screenplays together, that is it's still channeling. We're still getting in the flow together. We're still getting in the zone. But instead of necessarily channeling psychic information from spirit, we are actually what I feel is we are reaching into the ethers, we are reaching out to the muse, and we are saying, okay, in this specific kind of structure, a script, which is going to be 90 pages with a beginning, middle, and end, and certain structural points that you need to hit along the way, and in this genre, we're channeling specifically for that. Just like if I'm doing a tarot card reading, if I'm doing a Celtic cross, that's going to be different than if I do like a three-card pull, which is going to be a little bit different than a five-card pull, right? So it's like, it's just amending the channel to what we're doing. Or if I'm playing music, if I'm singing a song that I didn't write, then I am allowing the divinity of that music to come through me, through my instrument. It's the same as psychic channeling, but it's just with different parameters because you're singing according to a score. Although I'll tell you, a lot of times when I'm singing songs, because I am such an improviser, so used to channeling as a psychic, a lot of times I don't get the words exactly right. I get the intention right. So if I'm singing a Disney princess song and somebody's, you know, Disney fans are hardcore, they know the words. If I sing the song maybe emotionally in line with what the song is, but I get the words wrong, boy, people will let you know.
I bet they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Because when I was little, of course, I knew all the words from playing that record, the song over and over and over and over. Yeah, and if somebody had even just one word out of line, boy, I could correct them immediately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally.
That's cute.
Did you do?
So that explains it. Yeah, you did that very succinctly. How it when you reach out to the ether, to the views. I love that. And
yeah,
do what you need.
So for you growing up, has that been something that you feel like your intuition was helping you open up and discover? Or do you feel like that was kind of always there and there wasn't really a opening up of it? It just, you just always have been kind of working in that way. I guess the reason why I ask is because have these different talents shown up in different times in your life? Or have you just really had them from the beginning?
Well, that's a great question. And I feel, and also because it's weird for people, right? It's weird if someone does five different things and we're not used to that here. In Iceland, for example, many people have professional careers. Let's say you're a doctor, a lawyer, and they, in Iceland, they write and publish more books than in any other country in the world. They have,
oh, wow,
by the way, like, I think it's 100% literacy rate in Iceland. Now, that's a small country with not a huge population, but this, so there will be a lot of people who will be excellent at three things. They're great lawyers or doctors or whatever their professional career may be, psychics, whatnot. Then they also write and publish books, and then they're also like a visual artist. And it's not weird. It's not like, wait, you know, that joke we have here of master or jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah,
I just don't think that's true for everyone. Think about Leonardo da Vinci. Now, I'm not saying I'm Leonardo da Vinci, but that was someone who was a true Renaissance man who could do, he did painting, sculpture, anatomy. He was also apparently an amazing chef, pushing the boundaries on cuisine. Or if you think about, little known fact, Shakespeare, right? Shakespeare, of course, wrote all those amazing plays from comedy to tragedy to in between. Also, apparently Shakespeare was an incredible mathematician, but only as a hobbyist because he wasn't formally trained in math. But it's sort of like, what? Right? Like, who knew that? I just learned that. And so as a kid, I always was inclined toward storytelling and performing. But I was also always psychic. I always knew things I wasn't supposed to know. And in fact, I did very well in school. But I'll tell you, when I took the college entrance exams and like the ACT and the SAT, the truth of the matter is, even though I did study because I do like learning, a lot of the times I really took those tests on my intuition. Like I didn't, were a lot of my friends really freaked out ahead of time and studied. Of course, I had been studying all along, so I'm not a last-minute person if I can help it. And at the night before, I just got a good night's sleep. I went in, and I sat down, and I did what if I knew the answers, or if I was good, I do like, deducing answers. Great. But if I really couldn't quite know, then I would go with my intuition, and it worked. I did really well on those tests. And I really think that, I know that intuition isn't always the same as scientifically correct, right? Like, think about medieval times. People thought there was a long period of time in which people thought that the bubonic plague was spread by cats. So people were getting rid of their cats, which of course increased bubonic plague because it was spread by rats and the cats were taking care of the rats. So it's like, that was what their, I don't know if that was their intuition told them that, or if that was just the best they could come up with. So I know that it's not always an exact, intuition is the opposite of an exact science. And yet, it is those hunches, like Einstein himself said, imagination is more important than knowledge. It's the imagination and the willingness to pursue that and ask questions. Well, what's underneath that? Well, what goes with that? So to roll back to the question, as a kid, I always was kind of all of it. I'm not saying I was great at everything or really good, but I did have certain natural abilities that I then had to learn to work with and hone. So I always had a huge voice, a big voice, and therefore people with big voices, sometimes they sing flat, sometimes it's harder for them to learn to really get it right in the pocket. So I had to really learn how to deal with my voice, and that took, especially through puberty, that took some time to really be able to have a technique to match the level of bigness of my voice, especially because I'm a normal sized woman, but I'm not like a big person, but I have this giant voice coming out of me. And so it sort of always seemed a little weird until I could work with it and know how to use it. And I think the same thing goes with like a psychic channel. Until I know a lot of people who aren't, I don't want to say it's not just about being a professional, but I know a lot of people who are psychic, but who are afraid of the information that comes through. Or like, I have a friend who's like, I'm psychic, but I know too much and it scares me, so I just want to shut it down. And I think until you learn how to work with turning it on, turning it up, turning it off, working with the channeled information, working with yourself as the vessel, yeah, it can be overwhelming, for sure.
That's exactly why I asked the question, because I feel that we do have this sort of weird thing on us here in the United States where if you are talented, so to speak, you only have one. And it is unusual to have the multi-talented person, even though I feel like you explained, you had those talents your whole life. And many of us do. It's more of a, how do we psychologically manage that for ourselves? And so thank you for talking about that, because I feel like a lot of us, and I'm including myself in this, where I feel like I've been sort of like my hands have been tied behind my back in not being able, like feeling comfortable or safe to reveal some of my talents, or I've had to really work at that. And so I just wanted to ask you that, because I want everyone to feel inspired to go after it, because the world is not going to ever send us an invitation and say, come on out and do it. You know what I mean? Like, but
yeah, never.
Like our stories and hearing how people do it, that can help though. And I feel like you have such a great story of actualizing your talents and really getting to the point where you can handle that kind of energy moving through you, and it's no longer overwhelming. You actually like thrive in it, like riding on a surfboard, like on riding the wave. And so that's really exciting to hear.
I've often wondered, somebody who has such a multi and diverse set of talent and things, those things come more easily to them, if it's not a partially like a past life thing, like in one life you did nothing but you focused on dance, you were a dancer, next you were a musician or whatever, and that some of that is a carryover or a leftover. And because there's how some people can just pick stuff up so fast, just like a depth of water,
when you see those little kids that sing, like there's some 90-year-old blues singer, it's like, where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly, that's what I'm talking about. There's no real answer to this question. It's just something I always think of in the back of my mind when I see that these little kids that are savants.
Totally. Well, I have an interesting story about my palm, When I was 19 years old, I lived in a big house in Minneapolis by the University of Minnesota. It was like a my girlfriends and I rented the first floor, and then the second floor was like they rented it room by room. So it was like a rooming house kind of thing. And upstairs, there was a guy, a friend of mine named Ahmed, and Ahmed was from Pakistan. He was the son of a politically important person, and he was at the University of Minnesota because the University of Minnesota has this has an incredible agricultural technology program, and he was getting his PhD in that. But he had a gift for palm reading. Now he used a different term. He used the Egyptian term that starts with a K, I forget. But anyway, Kairos. Oh my gosh, somebody tell me. Anyway, he would told me that what would happen is when he was young, he had a gift, and then he read a book that helped him better understand it, and then he met someone who helped him really hone his skills. But because of his position in his family, he had read the palms not only of a lot of upper class, wealthy, academic, and politically important people in Pakistan, but also his uncle was in charge of prisons. And he was given permission to go into prisons and read the palm of people in prison and read the palm. So he had read, and then he had read so many different palms from so many different people from so many different walks of life. And then he looked at my palm and he said, "Wait a minute." And he ran up to his room and he came back with the book. And the book had pictures and sometimes very old-fashioned, you know what a daguerreotype is, where they would take the very, very, very old photo of people that, you know, we now think they're always not smiling or whatever.
Oh,
So he had this
yeah.
very, right? So he had this book had a daguerreotype of Sarah Bernhardt's palm. And she was the world's most famous actress at the end of the 19th century. She worked all over the United States, France, and England. And she was, for example, I don't know if she was the first woman, but the most prominent woman at that time to play Hamlet, for example. Very famous actress, theater actress, of course.
Yes, I've heard of her.
We have the same palm. He showed me, it was shocking. We have the same palm, like same lines in the same places, same shape. It was astonishing. It was, I mean, maybe a couple of lines here and there were different, but it was really, really astonishing. And he was like, he was convinced that there was a connection there, like you're talking about, Raven. And I was like, well, I'd love to get some of her success, but you know,
Right. Well, and
it would explain a lot.
it makes me wonder too, like when the whole doppelganger thing, I wonder if there's something to that too. Is there like a similarity in palms for doppelgangers, or is it deeper than that, like more along the lines of what you're saying here, where it's not necessarily about what you physically look like, but there still is a sign of that deeper connection or symbol.
That is amazing. David
Right.
Wilcock did a study on this, and he had some were, you know, more recent enough that you could have pictures. A lot of his stuff was before the camera was invented, but did comparisons of people today and famous people in the past. And he did some of it by astrology chart. But a lot of it was by photograph. Like he is they say he's the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. And there's a photo of
Wow.
Edgar and one of David Wilcock when his hair was much shorter and done differently. That, yeah, the jawline is there, that like, slack jaw that they've got. You can see the resemblance easily. It's not a stretch of the imagination. He was doing a study that there is a carryover. There's always some sort of carryover from the most recent past life. So you
Wow.
could be Sarah Bernhardt.
I mean, that'd be cool. That'd be amazing. I mean, it's incredible. I also feel like when I was little, I always knew all the words to all these songs from the 1930s, like things I shouldn't know. And I remember once I was singing this song to it was my uncle John's mother. They lived in the same town, and she came over, and she had Alzheimer's. She didn't remember anybody. She insisted I was her friend Gertie. And she said, "Gertie, Gertie, sing with me the songs of the old days." And then she started singing, and I kid you not, We're in the money, we're in the money, we got a lot of what it takes to get along. And I maybe I had heard it, but I was like pretty little, and I just sang it with her like I knew the words. And my mother and my aunt were like, how do you know that song? Now, probably I had heard it, but part of me is, because that happened so many times again and again, I don't know, was I just psychically channeling out of this lady's mind, maybe? You know, was I just reading? That happened to me just the other day. I was FaceTiming with my cousin, and a song came to my head, and I was like, hey, a song just came into my head that I haven't thought about in ages. Do you remember that song by Big Head Todd and the Monsters? It's a bittersweet, more sweet than bitter, bitter than sweet. It's a bittersweet surrender. And my cousin was like, what? Oh my God. Her fiance had literally just been playing that song yesterday. And I was like, that's crazy. I was like, well, I'm just tuned in. I'm, you know, sometimes I think I'm
yeah.
tuned in, man.
Wow. I think songs and music often are signs from spirit. You know, you can be like walking through the room and there's a TV on and you'll hear something that you were wondering about. It's like it's an answer to a question, or you're thinking mm-hmm. about somebody, you hop in the vehicle, you turn on the radio and their favorite song is on the radio. Or
yeah, right.
I have really neat little synchronicities with music a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. And now I'm going to have that song stuck in my head all day. We're in the money.
It's a fun one.
Okay, so I want to turn the page, not pun intended,
ooh.
To Bad Sugar Baby.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I want to hear about what was, number one, when did the inspiration and the channeled idea come into your mind? And then when did you actually start to write it? I'm curious of how that process was for you.
This is an unusual experience for me because the people who are publishing it, they're called Finch Benson Publishing. And they are publishing a different novel of mine that I had pitched to them a while ago called Ghosting Shakespeare. Now, Ghosting Shakespeare, I dreamed the idea. I developed it over the course of a few years. I wrote it during quarantine. It got picked up by one publisher who then got canceled. They were falsely accused of racism, story for another time. And when they were brand new. And so then the book came back to me. I looked for an agent for that book. And then I finally found this group, and they love the book too. So they're going to publish it. But because it's about a haunted house, we all agreed that we should not publish it until autumn of 2024. So it'll come out September 2024. Well, meanwhile, I have done two one-woman shows in my life. And because I'm a singer and I need to perform like fish need water, I've been looking for ways to perform, other than I do sing in a cabaret every month. I'm grateful for that job. It's wonderful. But I've been looking for a way to perform that makes sense. Like, I don't feel like it makes sense for me to book a singer-songwriter night at a club anymore because I don't have that kind of audience anymore, because I don't want to do the work to rebuild that kind of audience. It's a lot of work. And what I do have is a lot of friends and an audience for something like a one-woman show. So my very first one-woman show that I ever did was called The One, and it was about my love life. And I would tell a story about my love life and then sing a song. So it was a little bit of stand-up, a little bit of story, and then there's an arc to it where you get to grow with me from being a totally insane person with relationships, totally crazy, to really understanding the common denominator in all of my awful, terrible relationships was yours truly, and how I learned how to stop attracting bad men and inappropriate men, and how, well, I did the show before I met my husband. And so I've been thinking about updating that show because a lot has happened 15 years later. You know, I met my husband, I got married, you know, I got fluent in Italian, I became someone who helps other people get out of unrequited love relationships. And I was thinking about things that would change in the show and whether or not I would include stories from my life as a massage therapist to the rich and famous, because that was the day job I had for a long time until I transitioned out of it. I just grew out of it. It was time to do only artistic and psychic work. And it was a wonderful job for a long time, but being a young woman in Hollywood. I had a lot of people be very inappropriate with me, and I was very strong, but I was remembering a story. This was in late January, early February of this year. I was remembering this client I had, and I used to, he was a showrunner. That means he invented and was the executive producer of a TV show that was very, very famous in the late 2000s, aughts, early teens. And I won't say what it was because I don't want to out him, for all kinds of purposes. But he was like, this was a man who could have changed my career, right? And he always wanted a massage in a hotel because he didn't want his wife to know he was getting massages because she was very jealous, and they were from a kind of background where they were a little more traditional in certain ways, and she wouldn't have been happy, and whatever, not my business. I was like, okay, even though it's not a happy ending massage, right? And he was like, you know that? And he's like, of course I know. And I have no problem with people who do happy ending massages. I never did them. That was not what I did. If that's what someone was looking for, I got really, after all the years of people asking, I just got really good at telling right away if somebody wanted something other than what I did, and saying, hey, if you're looking for a happy ending, go look at the back of the LA Weekly. If you want a great therapeutic, non-sexual massage, then you can book with me. And in fact, I even once had a client tell me, Aaron, the truth is, I used to always get happy ending massages, and I thought that's what you were going to give me, but your massage is so good, I don't even want the happy ending. So I remember him telling me that. I was like, I guess I'll take the compliment. Okay. So back to this guy, TV, Mr. Executive Producer. He started asking me if I would ever do happy endings, and he would pay me much, much more. And I said, I really don't do those. And he was like, but I'll pay you so much more. It would be so easy. And I was like, I don't do those. And then at one point, he was like, I would like to be your only client. And if you will meet me here once a week and give me happy endings, I will pay your rent, your bills, your groceries, and whatever else you need, acting class. And I was like, I have to think about that. And I literally went and spoke with my acting teacher at the time, and she was like, you know what, Aaron? You can't do it. You can't, because it would mess with your self-esteem. If you would do it for fun, if it's something that intrigued you, I would say go for it. But I just think it'll mess with your self-esteem. And I was like, I agree. I think it wouldn't be right for me, for me. So I went back to the guy and I said, I think we have to keep this just therapeutic massage. And he was like, oh, okay. And then he said, well, there's a movie coming out with there's a movie that I'm going to be producing. It's not coming out. There's a movie I'm going to be producing with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, and there's a role you could be right for as one of their daughters. She gets killed in the very beginning, so it would be a small role, but it would be memorable. And if you give me a happy ending, I'll get you an audition. And I said, tell you what, if you get me the audition, then after that, I will give you a happy ending. Because I was just like so tired of him saying that, but I was also like, I don't know. All right, fine, get me the audition. We'll figure the rest of it out later, right? I mean, I hope
That
nobody's
was smart.
clutching their pearls or whatever. But yeah, he turned to
Hey,
me and
keeping
he
the power.
laughed and he
That's
said,
keeping the power on your side, by the
Yeah,
way.
absolutely. Well done.
Right? Thank you. And he turned to me and he laughed. He goes, you're going to do great in this town, kid. And then he put his face back in the face cradle and he never got me the audition. He wasn't going to get me that audition. He just wanted the happy ending. He just, so I was remembering that incident. And as I was remembering that whole story, I thought, oh, that could make a really fun series or film. A young woman, late 20s, early 30s. And she, but she's not, but she is interested potentially in being a sugar baby. She isn't, like, I don't have moral compunctions if people want to do happy endings. I just know that for me, it's not right. So, like, or whatever. Like, I have no problem with people who want to do sex work. It's if that's what they want to do, if that's their currency, if they truly enjoy it, right? If it's really their thing. It's not my, like, I say, do whatever's right for you. For me, I just think I need too much freedom, and I'm way too much of an oxytocin bonder, and I'm, like a vulnerable in that way. So I don't think I'm strong enough to do it, but in that particular way. But I thought, what if it were a woman who, like, says, okay, I'm gonna try it, I'm interested, but then she's just really bad at it, because I know myself. I would be so bad at that kind of work because I just wouldn't be. First of all, I can't suffer fools. If some guy was an idiot, I wouldn't be able to handle it after a while. I would just have to tell him, and then I'd get fired.
Right,
And
right, yeah.
You know, like everything about me, like the way that I can be snarky and the way that I can start, really delivering high dudgeon, like Dorothy Spornak on Golden Girls. Like I can, like if I'm on a roll, if I get really pissed, I start delivering some pretty dry but not so nice statements that are, it's not my finest characteristic, but I can do it. So the idea came for this character and for this, this kind of heightened version of me, but she became someone different in the long run. And I just thought, oh, I wrote it down as a future project. Well, okay, back to these publishers. In March, they were like, we're so excited about ghosting Shakespeare, but that's a long ways away. Do you happen to have, like, I don't know, like a sexy beach read novella, something we could release to introduce you to our readers? And I was like, and I pitched a couple of, I had a screenplay that I could adapt easily as a book, not Bad Sugar Baby, but a different one. I pitched that and they're like, no, it's not quite right for what we're looking for. And I was like, well, how about this idea? And I told them about Bad Sugar Baby. I remember I was at the doctor's office getting my annual exam. My husband and I had made appointments back to back, and so I was in the waiting room while he was talking to the doctor, and I was messaging back and forth with them at the clinic, and they were like, "Oh my God, we love this idea!" And I was like, "Great, let's do it." And then I was like, "Oh, they wanted it by summer. I have to write a novella." Like oh my God, I have to write a novella by June. It was like it was March.
Ooh,
I was like, "How the
yeah,
fuck am I
that's
doing
ooh.
that?" Right? And it's also like I wasn't paid ahead of time. I didn't get a book advance. They're small publishers. That's not how it's working. So I was like, how am I gonna have the time to do it? But I thought, and so I decided, that I would just work a little bit every day and get up in the morning early like I do and just kind of work on it a little bit. And if I made it, great. And if I didn't, like I just took all the pressure off myself. I was like, you know what? Take the pressure away and just work out a little bit every day. Well, what happened is I couldn't let it go. I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about this. And I was like, okay, I have ideas. I came up with a way that it could work. I came up with the structure. I came up with her best friend character. Like it all just started coming to me. And I kept telling myself, no pressure, no pressure. But it just flowed. And I wrote the first draft in about 5 weeks. And then I sent it over to them. They sent me back edits. Now, like I wrote it probably between March 26th is the day we agreed I would write it. Over the course of the month of April, I developed the structure first. I developed the characters first. And then I started writing a little bit every day. And then I had it by the end of April. Well, really more like by May 8th, I think. No, May 15th, because I remember saying I want first draft done by May 15th. And my first draft, to be fair, it was probably more like a third draft, but I am very, very anxiety-ridden and perfectionistic in a kind of way, and that I'm like, I'm going to read a book 100 times before I send it to anybody else or anything I've written, like so many times to other people. I'm going to read it many, many times before I send it to somebody. But I sent it to them because I thought we could really do this. And if they like it, if they think it's where they want to go, then we'll go with it. And they sent it back that needed a little more. It wasn't perfect. It needed a little more expansion here, a little refinement there. And we did 2 rounds of edits, and I just reread it. And while the truth is, of course, I could keep working on it for 3 more years, I think the difference it would make is now in the single percentage points. I think that it's where it needs to be for what it is, which is a really fun novella about this woman who she's an aspiring writer. She's circa 30. She lives in Los Angeles. She's the personal assistant slash social media planner for a reality star turned social media influencer. And she loses her job because she's too honest, and so she's broke. And a friend suggests that maybe she should be a sugar baby, and she's like, "I'm not the type. I'm not physically, I don't look like an OnlyFans girl. I don't wear a lot of makeup. I'm wearing Doc Martens and band t-shirts all day. Like I'm not the kind of person that guys would want as a sugar baby." And her friend's like, "Of course you are. There's all kinds of people who want sugar babies that are all kinds of sugar babies." So she decides she's gonna try it out as a story. She's like, "You know what? Maybe this could be my break. If I write a story about this and I pitch it, maybe this is how I get my break as a writer, and maybe I make a little cash along the way. And of course, there's a learning curve that, by the way, does not go very well for her in the beginning because she has a lot to learn about how to become a sugar baby. She's just not good at it. So that's it. The
No.
book is her misadventures. Oops, there goes my phone. The book is her series of misadventures as a bad sugar baby.
Oh, how fun.
Well, and it sounds like it's perfect for this time, you know, the current pop culture, like what's kind of hot in the world, and especially, you know, you're right in the center of it. Both of us are in Los Angeles, I feel like, we're the hub of entertainment all over the world. And just being able to have the inside view that you did have into multiple worlds because of your work, I'm sure that's also given you a way to make this very captivating and exciting because you're giving us some of that insider information without actually giving it away about any one specific person.
Right. Thank you. I hope so. I will say, for example, her former boss, the social media influencer, I named her Milan in the book, but she is based on a couple an amalgamation of people I have encountered in real life. It's true. Yes.
These big stars that make it, ultra huge, do any of them get there unscathed?
No. At my experience, having massaged many very famous people, and some of whom are incredible people, and some of whom are not incredible people, just like any profession, I feel like everybody pays their dues one way or another. Even if you are a total nepo baby, you still face criticism. You still face people being angry at you for your luck. You still face people talking about your body, talking about your face, talking about you like you're not in the room. People criticizing your work, what you just said, what you did. The constant, if I think about people I know who are extremely famous, how hard it is for them to trust people because they don't know if somebody's just going to use them. If somebody's just trying to take advantage of them for their fame or for proximity to fame. But or people who worked really hard and came up out of lower or middle class lives and worked really, really, really hard to get wherever they go. I just feel like when I watch awards shows, I always feel like the Oscars, even though they're all having what should be the greatest moment of their lives, when I see the actors, I always feel like I can just see how sad, a lot of sadness that there is in their faces. And I think it's because right, they always look kind of sad. I think part of it is because being an actor is painful. Now, of course, it's not like being, no one's tied to a loom as like an 11-year-old in a third world country making clothes for $2 a day, right? I don't mean to compare that, but it's emotionally painful to be an actor. And also, you have to be so careful to not be too happy or too excited so that people resent you. Like, remember when Tom Cruise was on Oprah and he was so excited about Katie Holmes, he jumped on the off the couch and then everybody freaked out, It's like, or look what happened to Angelina Jolie that one day she's so skinny, she stuck her leg out and people were so mean to her about how she needed to eat a sandwich. And it's like, this is a woman who dedicates her life to helping children around the world, be fed, and we're picking on her for being skinny. Like people are mean to celebrities,
I
so.
always thought about that as an empath, and just from a standpoint of myself, just thinking about like if I were ever to somehow gain some like amazing notoriety as a psychic, for example, like how I almost have a fear of that level of success because of the amount of attention that is on you, and to like what you're talking about, like how like crazy and ridiculous and mean, downright mean people can be, but also learning how to find a way to, water off a duck's back. Do you have anything to say about that? Like, have you had to develop that muscle, or how does that work for you?
Well, I will say, even though I've never had quite the success at the level I would like to have, I've definitely had mean comments. And I've even gotten, in the early days of my music career, when I was touring on my own, I used MySpace, back in like 2003, 2004, to share my music. And I once even got a hate letter. I was like, who? It was so bizarre. This guy was like, you're not attractive enough for people to actually want to listen to your music. And it wasn't like you should die, but it was like, you should give up. You're never going to make it. It was very mean.
Wow.
And
Jeez. God.
I've had many mean comments on YouTube videos. And in the early days, I used to write, hey, there is a real person on the other side of this video here. But what I now do, if I get any weird or mean comments, is first, if I notice them, because I don't really engage, but if I notice them, I look to see if there's any kernel of truth in what they're saying. Like, not like, oh, I'll never make it. More like, did anybody give me an actual criticism I could use? Like, this story could have been better this way, or your acting could. I mean, I'm almost taking revenge by being like, you might be mean, but I'm going to grow from this. And then number two, if there is or if there isn't, I think about who is a person who is so small that they're going to be mean to somebody else that they don't even know, hiding behind a computer screen like a frightened little mouse. Like I just think it's pathetic. It's one thing if you offer actual criticism. I have friends who will give me actual criticism or constructive criticism. I have
Constructive
friends who are too
criticism, yeah.
blunt. Yeah, that's great. I love it. It's fabulous. Or maybe they give me their opinion and maybe I don't agree, and that's okay too. I've become very strong. But I feel to me like there's only so much stock that I'll put in to the words of people who either A are hiding, and therefore it's like, well, you're too afraid to even tell me who you really are. So no, I can't put stock in what you're saying. Or B, if it's somebody who really, a lot of people think they know and they don't. Like when my book was with a different publisher, it was with a different publisher, a new publishing company, and that new publishing company had a problem with an author that they were trying to work with, and that author, who by the way was a 17-year-old girl, decided she was going to take them down. And she went on Twitter and she falsely accused them of racism and added, she like, added a hashtag, all of us who happen to be white or white passing authors, and said, look, they say they're diverse and they're really not. Look at how white their authors are. And then she said, I'm so depressed, I feel suicidal. And maybe that was true for her, but what happened is it started a Twitter mob, and I watched the Twitter mob come after the publishing company and me and all of us authors. And I watched people tweet like, "Oh, I feel so bad for at Erin Carrera. Hope she's got a lawyer." And I was thinking to myself, "You all, whoever you are, which is probably primarily people who haven't looked me up, so you don't know that I'm like a 40-year-old woman living in Los Angeles who's had some moderate success in the entertainment industry. Yeah, I not only do I have two lawyers and I'm married to a lawyer. It's kind of like you're not, they weren't using their reasoning, they weren't using systemic thought to really think through what might be happening. They were just jumping on the bandwagon and then adding to the chatter and adding to the cruelty and adding to the joke of it all, thinking they were doing the right thing, probably. Even though in the end, the little girl who accused them of the publishers of being racist, in the end, she always had a cartoon picture for her profile pic. She said, "People wonder what I look like. Here you go." She was a white girl.
Oh my God. Jeez.
Like, what? So here's the whole thing was just a farce. So I tell that story because I think often of that Teddy Roosevelt speech, "The Man in the Arena." It's like, the critic doesn't count. If they're not the man in the arena, if they're not fighting, if they don't know what it's like to actually be doing that thing, it's not that I don't look for actual gold. Of course I do. If I have, like, I have, when I was doing music, I had fans And fans would tell me songs they liked of mine, songs they didn't. And it helped me understand how other people were receiving my work. Just like, right, it's the customer service thing. That's valuable. But if somebody's just being a troll, somebody just doesn't know, for the most part, I actually just feel bad for them because they don't know, and I think they look foolish.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice, and it really reminds me of something that Mark talks about too, of being that counter narrative voice to either whatever we're saying to ourselves, but also like as a filter for what is coming in from other people. So that way we aren't just stuck taking what they think about us like so to heart, you know, we don't just let it in without right. like some kind of discernment. And I've had to learn that because with no boundaries, I just always defer to the other person and they must be right because I need to, you know, they're the priority is just sort of like how I was brought up. And so it's been a thing to
yeah.
how to offer that back to myself and also then let different parts of myself shine differently. Because I've had different criticism come my way, but nothing like you. I haven't had any kind of a success like you haven't in Hollywood. But at the same time, I'm way more sensitive to it. And I've had to really develop a different kind of backbone to be able to stand in it and not shy away. And I feel like being here on 1-2 Radio has been a huge part of developing that. Because it's important, because we're vulnerable if we're worried about what someone's going to throw at us or say to us. Like, we're super vulnerable if that's the case. And I was, and I've had to really strengthen that. Do you have any, I don't know a better way to say, but off the cuff advice for anybody that is struggling in that department to be able to hold their space with other people and, you know, stick up for their desires?
I do, because I do understand, because I started out in life so shy. I was painfully shy, and I did not grow up with, my parents loved and supported me, but I didn't grow up in a town that supported the kind of person I was, and I had to learn to fit in, at least for a little while, even though, honestly, bad sugar baby, right? Like, I wasn't that good at fitting in. I just wasn't. I still am not good at fitting in, but I don't care about fitting in anymore. I just want to be me. And if you are someone who wants to write a book or wants to release music or wants to start a psychic medium business or wants to create art or wants to do something that might garner you criticism, I would ask you to remember the gift that you are to the world. And if you don't know that you're a gift to the world, I promise you, you are, because there is no one else like you on this planet. There is no other person who has what you have. And so we need you. And the proof that we need you here is that you are here. You are here. And if you remember the gift you are to the world and the gift the world can be to you and what you stand for and why you want to create something, then that will carry you through, because you can dig deeper into your own resolve, but you can also remember you're not in it alone. You have spirit, you have divine, whatever a person may believe. Even if a person is an atheist, although I don't know if we would have any straight, strictly atheist, you know, folks listening to 1-2 Radio, maybe. But even if someone's an atheist and believes in nothing, they still can understand that there is something greater than themselves, something greater than the total sum of all of their fears, and they can say, you know what, I am willing to lean on or ask for help for that which knows better than me, that which is greater than me. So, for example, I, as a spiritual person, if I get scared, when I get scared, when I get nervous, when I get vulnerable, when I get bad criticism, that's pain, it isn't easy to take, but I also say, okay, but I'm not alone, and I'm calling upon spirit to support me through this experience. I will also pay attention to my body. So I will engage with the criticism as feels appropriate, but I also have the freedom to take breaks, and I also have the freedom to go away and get away. And even, you know, a person that I used to massage who's extremely famous, they found ways to protect themselves, right? They found ways to work through and work around when people were clobbering at them or mobbing up on them. And it was very much about finding trusted people who would support them and understand. And it was very much about honoring their own needs and self-care. So I think it's a combination of remembering why you're doing what you're doing in the first place and the deep love that inspired you to do it in the first place. And then number two, self-care. And really, I know that's almost overused now, but understanding, okay, if something's becoming too much, I need to give myself a break from it now then. And that's okay too. That's okay.
Thank you so much for that. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead, Raven. Mm-hmm. I know you probably have a question.
Yeah, and I know we're getting down on the time, and I wanted to ask about the energy that you take in from the audience when you're doing a live performance.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, do you have like a David Wilcock was talking about this, and so that he would have to walk up and down the beach after he got off the air. This was just radio, doing coast to coast, because so many people were focused on him, and he had just an energy overload. And this was just over the radio waves, and he would have to walk it off. So when you get done performing, do you have like an excess of energy? Have you taken in energy from the audience, and what do you do with it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, even in smaller shows, if it's like 30 people, 50 people in the audience, which is like the cabaret I sing at is usually around 50 to 80 people. It's not usually huge, but still a lot of people. I am so charged, and I am so, like, it takes quite a long time for me to come down from that. Also, being on set takes a long, long time for me to come down. Sometimes I get so wired, it is like hard to sleep. And especially like if you have to, you know, if I've done a job down in Dana Point, which is maybe an hour and a half, or during traffic, 2.5 hours from me, driving is really hard. What I do though is I don't try to stop it. I don't try to cut it off. I'm used to it now, right? I've been doing this for decades. So I'm used to the fact that there's going to be a lot of energy, and I just work to stay in my body, because, you know, a little Pisces over here. I work to be grounded and in my body. So I have some breathing techniques I do. You know, I definitely think about the bottoms of my feet. Imagine I'm breathing in the bottoms of my feet. Think about my root chakra. Imagine I'm breathing into the root chakra. I might do some counting breathing, you know, like 4, 7, 8 breathing. But then I just allow the experience to ride out as if I'm surfing. And I let the energy stay. And if I'm going to stay up late, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I don't like to lose sleep. So if I have a gig that's late, I do try to plan so that the next morning I can sleep in, or at least even if I can't sleep in, so that I try to not have anything intense to do the next morning other than maybe a workout to let some of that energy still go. Because, like a gentle workout, a low impact, because, you know, I don't want to exhaust myself either, like I did in my 20s and 30s. I'm not interested in exhausting myself, but it's probably not the best answer. What I do is I just ride it out, you know, I just ride out the energy, and I plan around it. Because if I don't ride it out, I might eat a lot of food that I don't really want to eat. I don't really drink that much, but you know, I don't want to drink to numb the energy, and I don't want to get addicted to the energy either. Although it is pretty exciting.
I was going to ask you if it was addicting.
A little. It is. It is a little addicting. Yeah. You know, there's nothing that feels like that. This feels so amazing. It's just so alive and so heightened.
That Lindsay Logan, I think her name is, she's an actress. She ran around with Paris Hilton. And I read an article once that said that they get in trouble because, like in between Lindsay Lohan's movies, because she's addicted to that attention, that energy, she's addicted to the energy from the attention, and that they'll act out and do bad things and get arrested and be, you know, all over the tabloids because they're feeding off that energy.
Yeah, and if you don't know where to put it, like if you're not doing a movie at that time, and you don't know how to meditate, or you don't have another practice like Taekwondo or painting or, right, like some kind of practice, a structured practice, tennis, whatever, just something that's structured, but specifically to put that energy into, I could see why, well, we know a lot of people who run around getting in trouble, don't we?
We sure do. So we've talked down to the end of the show, and Erin has her show, the Erin Carrera Show, coming up right after this. And in if you can do it in 30 seconds, can you give us a plug of where to find you, and again to remind everybody when they can get your book?
Yes, you can. Thank you. Find me at Erin Carrera anywhere online. I'm all over Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. You'll see my One to Listen Erin for my One to Listen work on Instagram. You'll find me at onetolisten.com/Erin. That's Erin with an E. And you can find Bad Sugar Baby July 2nd. It's available now for pre-order as an ebook. And actually, there are a couple advanced reader copies available. So I don't know how many are left, but I'm going to put up a link that on the chat room, if people want to download the ebook as an advanced reader copy, I just ask that you give me a glowing review, or as if you don't like it, just don't give any review.
There you go. Right.
Thank you so much, Erin, for coming
Okay.
on this morning. It's
Yes,
been
thank
a
you.
pleasure and an honor. We gotta go, everybody. But stick around because Erin's coming up next.
Right. See you next week.